Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today, broadcasting live, but not video streaming, from our studios in New York City. Once a year, I do a commentary on the issues that I find important that I don't believe the average American is aware of. I do this so that those individuals who don't generally have a forum will have one for this audience, and it's a large and very progressive audience. So without guests, but with commentaries from many different individuals, beginning with Bob Sloan from the Voters Legislative Transparency Project, turning state legislators into brothels. Then following that will be New ALEC Document Shows Regulatory Capture in Action by Lee Fang from TheNation.com. Why am I doing these two? Because right now, hundreds upon hundreds of laws at the state level are passed that guarantee the rights of corporations and not citizens. In fact, this is all done in secret, and I will go through that in greater detail. But ALEC, which is the group that really represents mainstream corporate America, works hand in hand with the state legislators. We're not aware of this, and that's why, for example, when we saw that they wanted to make the Gardasil vaccine mandatory in every state, and I thought, but how could they possibly suggest that? The science shows that it doesn't benefit anyone. There's no real science. I wrote several articles about the Gardasil vaccine, and others who've done the same have come to the same conclusion. So suddenly a vaccine that's never been shown to be beneficial, that it has never been shown to prevent cervical cancer, and the young girls receiving it, but have killed over 110 girls and have injured over 24,000 girls, that's going to be mandated, but then you're going to have tens of thousands of deaths and millions of injuries. It was ALEC behind the group doing this in one of its pharmaceutical companies, and they were getting this done. So time and again, when we're told that something is good for us, that we need something, it's not. That's why that commentary is important. And then Naomi Wolf from The Guardian on how the FBI coordinated the crackdown on Occupy Wall Street with a full cooperation and working hand-in-hand with Wall Street banks who actually selected the targets. This is full police state. This is not a conspiracy theory. I'll go into that. And also, when I suggested that many places on the ocean are sinking, well, Jakarta just announced today that it's sinking as water supplies dry up, and that they're going to have to build a huge wall in order to stop the ocean from swamping parts of a city that has 10 million people. Also, did you know that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, allows uranium mining that pumps toxic, deadly waste into drinking water? Who knew? But from ProPublica, you'll see the raw story. You'll see it by Abraham Lustgarten from ProPublica. So we're going to show you what the EPA really does and why it does it. If time permits, what's happened to our infrastructure? I have spent a lot of time in the last 24 months traveling around our country, and I see the infrastructure. But unless you're on the ground and you're driving, you're going over bridges and in tunnels, if you're looking at our roads, you won't know all that's wrong. We'll talk about it. Also from Professor John Cozy, Global Research, the fraudulent educational reform in America. Why don't we have good education? Why aren't we graduating more really highly literate, informed, and fully prepared students? But we're not. And there's a reason why we're not. I'll deal with that. And finally, I intend to address the many ways that President Obama has betrayed the very people who voted for him. I'm going to be very specific, using his own record statistics on this. So I'm going to talk about how he betrayed the labor movement that supported him, and without that movement, he wouldn't have won. How he betrayed the middle class and families. He betrayed seniors. He betrayed our health. He betrayed our veterans. He betrayed democracy. all that in my final run-up to the end of the program. All of this is intended to give us an understanding of problems from a different perspective. So let's begin. First up, we're going to take a look at who makes our laws and how do they do it. In a perfect world, we as citizens in a representative democracy would elect those who best represent our views on issues critically important in our lives. In the context of that perfect world, our elected representatives would work tirelessly pursuing legislation that would benefit we, the constituents, and thus earn the respect of all of the voters and ensure their re-election. However, in America, this is the basis that formed the foundation of our government. Unfortunately, we do not have a perfect world with regard to those who represent us. Far from it. You've heard my disdain time and again about those in power and why we continue to believe that those in power would represent us when they almost never do. Today, we elect those who will take office and then essentially sell their votes to corporations and special interests, which are not allowed to vote for elected officials in our democracy, wealthy or powerful entities in whose interest is to keep these captured legislators in office term after term. Many elected officials take office and then ignore the needs of their legislative beneficial commitments to the community that they were supposed to represent until those constituents are needed in subsequent elections, and sometimes even then officials count on voters not being aware how their vote was sold out. I think you can see this now with gas hydrofracking in New York and in New Jersey, certainly in Pennsylvania. ALEC is all behind that. The gas companies, their talking heads, their experts are absolutely in control of that. And yet gas hydrofracking, like nuclear, is not in our interest. It's not cheap, it's not safe, it's not green, and it's extremely dangerous. And these aging nuclear reactors, some over 50 years old, all of them emitting radiation into our environment every day, 24/7, they are protected because they got their state representatives on their side, federal representatives on their side. This is what happens time and again. Some ask, how has this come to pass? Who's responsible for undermining our democracy and corrupting our elected representatives? Nearly 40 years ago, a group of wealthy elites dedicated to expanding the power of corporations and so-called conservative ideologues, whose ideas were at the fringes of the political spectrum, met and formed what became the American Legislative Exchange Council, or it is known worldwide, ALEC. In addition to the wealthy corporations, ALEC was launched with influential state and federal lawmakers and advisors who also shared the conservative ideology. Today, these businessmen and women and policymakers have systematically changed the fabric and face of the American political stage. They almost always operate in secret. Back then, opponents of the conservative agenda laughed at the attempts of that small group of individuals breaking away from the mainstream political machinery in an attempt to advance their brand of government by and for corporate elite. ALEC wasn't taken seriously in the mid-1970s, just as the Tea Party wasn't taken seriously when it was launched in 2009. In this regard, history has shown that it can and will repeat itself when society does not learn from past events. Today, nearly four decades of growth and development have allowed ALEC to become the most effective tool in the arsenal of those seeking to usurp the power from and control of our state governments, and has also been playing an increasing role in congressional policies along with the corporations that bankroll it. Without ALEC and its unique access to lawmakers, conservative ideologues would be limited to espousing rhetoric, complaining and fighting continuously for small wins at the ballot box and within legislatures nationwide. It is not by accident that the last three GOP speakers of the House are or were ALEC members, including Hastert, Gingrich, and Boehner. Nor is it coincidental that several Republican House majority leaders are or were ALEC alumni and supporters, Cantor, Armey, and Tom DeLay. And GOP Senate leaders Tom Daschle were staff of the Senate leader Brian Kelly, working in Bill Frist's Senate office. And GOP leadership in states is likewise heavy with ALEC influence. In 2001, ALEC members held more than 30 House and 20 Senate leadership positions, governorships and cabinet positions, and more. Among the leadership of America's state legislators, ALEC members holds an impressive presence: 32 speakers and Speaker pro tem, 22 Senate presidents and Senate President pro tems, 22 Senate majority and minority leaders, 30 House majority and minority leaders. ALEC alumni include 8 sitting governors, 3 lieutenant governors, 2 senior cabinet level positions, and more than 80 members of Congress. ALEC moves the pathways to the creation, presentation, and passage of laws and resolutions and constitutional amendments that benefit the minority conservative factions in the United States and of late internationally. With nearly 100 sitting U.S. congressional members and just under 2,000 state legislative members, ALEC honestly claims to be the most influential and private political legislative organization in the United States, helping to write and pass hundreds of state laws every year. Now, these new and revised laws reflect their conservative ideology and benefit the nearly 300 corporate sponsors that fund ALEC's operations. Articles and exposés over the past 2 years have identified many of the wealthy industrialists and manufacturers and individuals involved in creating what can only be called a cabal that includes ALEC, dozens of think tanks, Heritage, Heartland, Mackinac, Cato, Goldwater Institute, and the Pacific Legal Foundation. Organizations such as David Koch's Americans for Prosperity and Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform. At the pinnacle of the funding source for the cabal sits David and his brother Charles Koch and their multi-million-dollar family foundations. Other wealthy families that have helped fund the cabal are families such as the Coors, the DeVos, the Schaefs, the Bradleys, and other lesser-known billionaires or millionaires. Together, they have contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to advancing a conservative ideology and agenda worldwide, not just through ALEC. Many of these elites fund multiple groups to advance their ideological agenda. For example, the Kochs fund AFP, which in turn funds efforts to posture that there is grassroots support for things as corporate wish list, as the right to work battle in Michigan this month or last month. Membership in ALEC is not required of all the cabal members, only if they help fund, support, and advance the legislative efforts put forth by ALEC. The methodology used to accomplish what can only be called a quiet coup by this cabal was simplistic and effective, it including revising U.S. history to the claim that Thomas Jefferson would support the ALEC model of corporate involvement in government, using Orwellian phraseology to confuse and confound the public. Terminologists such as patriotic, liberty, free markets, limited government, individual freedom has been adopted by the cabal, although they have an entirely different connotation and meaning to them than they do to us as citizens. The ALEC cabal defines free markets as the ability of private companies to operate free of any government intervention. Limited government means opposition to crucial reforms to protect against another Wall Street meltdown and a government unable to provide adequate protections for workers' longstanding rights. And individual freedom is defined as a way that elevates corporate freedom over citizens' freedoms. In order for the cabal's agenda to work fully, we as a society must relinquish our protected freedoms and liberties so that the corporate elite get their way. In order to succeed, the cabal needed a way to influence the public, to change established concepts about American culture and politics and government, and to advocate for the corporate legislative wish list approved through Alec. To do this, they needed to misinform the masses, and to do so in such a way that they controlled the delivery system as well as the message. The cabal and their corporate affiliates have acquired control over major media outlets in the United States and UK. They own broadcasting and print and investigative and digital media. Men with names like Rupert Murdoch and Robert Ailes, and companies they owned or controlled, such as Bain Capital, acquired corporate media outlets through purchase or merger acquisition. For example, Clear Channel Communications, owned by Bain Capital and Thomas Lee Partners. Now, Bain Capital is not an ALEC member, though Clear Channel uses Fox Broadcasting to advance the ultra-conservative rhetoric. So once you look at all the different things that they own just about everything that gets to us as far as the media. They have initiatives to do everything they want. Through their controlled media, the cabal has been able to dispense huge doses of propaganda directly to the public. Philosophy and agenda-critical initiatives originating within the cabal hierarchy are handed over to the think tanks such as the Heritage Foundation and the Mackinac Center and the Cato Institute, the Heartland Institute, and Americans for Prosperity. The think tanks and organizations produce videos and articles and studies and favorable reports to the cabal's position that are often then amplified by their controlled media outlets. Opposition views are downplayed by the same media or not reported at all except via alternative media sources such as this that you're listening to now. And we have, need to say, a very small audience compared to the huge audience that they have and own. In this manner, the cabal is able to sway the opinion of the general public, who too often only get one side of an issue, and it's always a distorted side at that. Initiatives to eliminate unions, right to work, or Paycheck Protection Act, or Public Employee Freedom Act, or Employee Rights Reform Act initiatives to expand privatization, which is bad, of public services, which is terrible, now called Competitive Contracting, a Public Service Act, and the Private Correctional Facility Act, and the Council on Efficient Government Act, are all disguised. What these really are? They're all forms of legislative proposals that have benign titles, but do not accurately reflect the substance of the proposed laws. An early key initiative of the cabal was the exploitation of prison labor. They wrote and urged passage of model legislation called the Prison Industries Act, and that allowed private companies to partner with state prison industry operations to use inmate labor to manufacture consumer goods. Jobs that paid American workers fair and living wages disappeared as more and more companies moved entire operations behind prison fences, where inmates work with minimum wage or less, producing millions of products for sale to the public. Now, using the phraseology that by doing this, they were, quote, providing valuable training that would allow prisoners to return to their communities with skills and experience to secure good jobs and thus not return to prison, advocates were able to get public support for such programs, and support predicated on the public not being fully informed of the consequences of other businesses or prisoners. In essence, they created an entire slave labor gulag in all the prisons they had influence, so that people would work for pennies an hour, but the final product sold to the public or to government agencies was massively profitable. Now, when was the last time you looked at a tag that said, made by indentured prison labor? You didn't. It's not there. But it could be. Training was not the motivating goal of the corporations. They lied. Rather, it was reducing the cost of operations to manufacturers through low wages, no vacations, no health or medical insurance costs, no matching or Social Security deductions, and no unemployment insurance premiums required for prisoner workforces. Since 1990, tens of thousands of private and public sector jobs have been lost to prison inmate labor through the use of ALEKS's Prison and Industries Act, and for providing factually false information to the taxpayer about the use of prison labor, the cabal has been able to divert jobs, depress wages, and replace private and public sector employees with prisoners. The cabal also pressed for new criminal laws and revised dozens more to incarcerate more and more Americans for longer. The war on drugs, three strikes laws, minimum mandatory sentencing, so-called truth in sentencing laws, and limits on the chance of parole have all led to mass incarceration in the U.S. Taxpayers bear the brunt of paying the incarceration costs to keep the prison workforce in place, healthy, clothed, fed, and available for years of work in prison factories. There's no reduction in the cost of incarceration, little or no reimbursement to the public for their part in providing this workforce. Product costs to the consumers are not dramatically lower, but profits are. Today, the Department of Justice has transferred oversight of the prison industry program to a private association, the National Correctional Industries Association, to run and have full control over this program, which is called the Prison Industries Enhancement Certification Program. This was accomplished by a Texas state lawmaker and ALEC member sitting as chairman of the Criminal Justice Task Force lobbying on behalf of the group, the National Corrections and Industry Association, for the Department of Justice to relinquish control to the special interest group representing prison industries and their vendors. This is simply one example that has transferred millions of tax dollars to private companies. All of these ALEC legislative acts are drafted within ALEC's task force working groups, secretly voted upon by corporate and legislative members, and once adopted as model legislation, they were provided to lawmakers in every state, submitted as proposed state laws in every legislature. ALEC claims a 20% success rate of bills ultimately passed and becoming law. This was clearly exposed over the past year with the cabal's pursuit of the Voters' Rights Act and the Voter ID Act. These ALEC legislative bills would make it harder for American citizens to vote and disproportionately and adversely affect students and the elderly and Hispanics and African Americans, those considered predominantly Democratic voters based upon exaggerated claims of voter fraud. What all the bills and the terminologies used have as a commonality is the fact that each proposed law by ALEC are or were to the benefit of their ideology and to increase profits or reduce liabilities to their corporate sponsors. None were written to primarily benefit the public in general. For example, the tax bills cutting various taxes theoretically benefit all taxpayers, but disproportionately benefit the wealthiest few while making it harder for government to provide basic services to all Americans and crucial services to the most vulnerable among us. They were not written or intended to benefit the rights of American workers to negotiate with powerful corporate managers or to help make it easier for all Americans to vote and aid small businesses, as opposed to some of the biggest corporations in the world, which fund ALEC. They were not written to improve a citizen's role in local democracy, such as zoning laws that would limit factory farms or nuclear power plants and ones in the backyard. No. Each proposed or model bill spelled out of ALEC is required to have the approval of the corporate membership of ALEC on a given ALEC task force, and that approval is withheld if a specific bill does not benefit the corporate bottom line or the ideological interests of the billionaires like the Koch brothers in some manner. ALEC's public bylaws specifically require ALEC and state chairman to ensure introduction of this organization's model legislation in their state legislatures. Through the efforts of the likes of Charles and David Koch, our elected officials are no longer ours. Once elected to office, they are pursued by ALEC and the cabal, plied with great trips to resorts and exotic locales, with corporate lobbyists and other perks, introduced to corporate lobbyists to help the legislators advance their interests, and indoctrinated with propaganda to back up the corporate or ideological agenda of ALEC's private sector members, such as the notion that increased CO2 is good for you. In reality, our state legislators or general assemblies have become brothels, home to dozens of what can only be described as coke whores, owned by the coke cabal and doing their bidding. Conservative lawmakers holding membership in ALEC have a loyalty to the cabal, their ideology, the corporate sponsors, the corporate lobbyists whose CEOs pump lots of money into political campaigns and therefore help control everything. No longer do these elected officials do much to serve their constituents or communities. Instead, they serve the will of those with the money and the influence that can advance the individual lawmaker's career. And over the past decade, the cabal has expanded, exporting the ALEC agenda to Congress and beyond. The cabal's philosophy and ideology is now being pursued with so-called fellow conservatives in the United Kingdom and European Union and other places. So in summation, we're having to look at the world in which we live today. And what I am seeing is that virtually all of our laws at the state level and at the federal level do not benefit us and were not never meant to benefit us, but rather benefiting those of the ALEC main 300 corporations. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you all over the world. I'm Gary Nall, and this is our once-a-year special report on issues that are not being examined at all by the mainstream or alternative media, but are by the independent and progressive media, of which we are the primary voice. I have selected some topics. I won't be able to get to all of them, about how our kids are getting hooked on pills for life, and what is happening to our economy, and the war is worth waging. What war? In Afghanistan. Why? Because of the minerals and natural gas there. We will get to those on upcoming commentaries in the main program. Let us now go to some other issues. What about our decaying infrastructure? We should be putting money behind this, because if we don't, here's what happens. Communities all up and down the West Coast and East Coast will simply suffer from increasing storm surges and as the ocean takes back the coastline. That is happening now. That is not some futuristic scenario. Sandy was one simple glimpse, and that was a very low-level glimpse. It is only going to get worse. But we're not doing anything to stop that. And what about large communities living on absolutely going to happen earthquake fault lines? We just don't know when. Nothing's being done. Nothing meaningful. And what about the areas running out of water? What about the bridges that need repair and the absolutely archaic grid, electrical grids, gas mains, broken water mains? How about all the dams that are going to break? We're not dealing with this because we've reprioritized our war on terror and the military-industrial complex's wish list ahead of what it means for our local infrastructure. I'm now going to share from Economic Collapse blog facts about America's decaying infrastructure. The number one society of civil engineers has given America's crumbling infrastructure for overall grade D. D. Not an A, not a B, not a C, a D. There are simply not enough roads in the United States today. Each year, traffic jams cost the commuters over 4.2 billion hours and over 2.8 million additional gallons of gasoline. It is being projected that Americans will spend an average of 160 hours stuck in traffic annually. Approximately one-third of all roads in the United States are substandard condition. Close to a third of all highway fatalities are due to a substandard road condition or obsolete road designs or roadside hazards. One out of every four bridges in the United States either carries more traffic than originally intended or is in need of repair. Repairing all the bridges in the United States that need repairing would take about $140 billion. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, our decaying transportation system costs the U.S. economy $70 billion annually. There are 4,095 dams in the United States. They're at risk of failure. That's 4,095. Of all the dam failures that have happened in the United States since 1874, a third of them have happened in the last 10 years. Close to half of all U.S. households do not access a bus or even a rail transit system. Our aging sewer systems spill more than a trillion gallons of untreated sewage every single year. That's a trillion gallons. The cost of cleaning up that sewage each year is estimated to be $50 billion. It is estimated that rolling blackouts and inefficiencies in U.S. electrical grid cost U.S. economy $80 billion a year. It is being projected that every single major container port in the United States will be handling at least double the volume that it was originally designed to handle in the next 6-7 years. All across the United States, conditions at many of our state parks and recreational areas and historical sites are deplorable at best. Today, the U.S. spends about 2.4% of gross domestic product on infrastructure. China spends 9%. In the United States today, approximately 16% of our construction workers are unemployed. China has plans to build 55,000 miles of highway. If all those roads were put end to end, it would be longer than the total length of the entire U.S. interstate system. The World Economic Forum ranks the U.S. infrastructure 23rd in the world. We fall a little farther behind the rest of the developed world every single day. It has been projected it would take $2.2 trillion over the next 5 years just to repair our existing infrastructure. That does not include a single penny for badly needed new infrastructure. And we haven't talked about this at all. The only time you ever hear of infrastructure is when there is a major natural disaster, and then suddenly a dam fails and whole areas are flooded, or a bridge collapses, or tunnel collapses, or gas mains explode. That's unfortunate. From Professor John Cozy about our educational system. In the 1960s, according to Professor John Cozy, he says, quote, "I came across a little book entitled Master Teachers and the Art of Teaching. This unpretentious little book, written by John Coleman of St. John's University, not only enlightened me as a young university professor, but provided to be invaluable. In it, about a dozen different teaching methods are described, along with some of the information about the master teachers who designed them. Each of these methods was used successfully to teach some students some subjects. None was used successfully to teach all subjects to all students. Throughout my teaching career, I found opportunities to utilize many of these methods when the right situations arose. The lesson I learned from this little book is that there is no one teaching method that works for teaching all subjects to all students. Finding the right method for the students at hand is at best an art, never a science, and never easy. Few people understand this. In fact, teaching training suppresses it. Teaching methods are taught to prospective teachers as fixed, reliable procedures that never fail, when in reality, they rarely succeed. And although carried out in numerous variations, the predominant way of teaching in American schools at all levels has been the teacher's lecture and the student's need to memorize it. Today, the lecture is often presented in various ways. The student listens to a teacher speak or reads a teacher's words in a textbook or watches a television presentation or a computerized video. And students are asked to memorize some portion of the presented material. Furthermore, the memorization of presented material is the most boring way of teaching anyone anything. No one likes having to memorize stuff. Some teachers, like orators, are better at lecturing than others, which leads many to conclude that the quality of the presentation is what really matters, and that the quality depends upon the teacher's talent. But it does not. Teaching is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for learning. Human beings have been teaching themselves and others for millennia before we know as what a teacher ever existed. The history of education in America makes that transparently clear. Even the Puritans had ways of teaching their children, but the final first normal school, a school to train students to be teachers, didn't come into being until 1839, less than two centuries ago. It resulted in building a school system modeled on an industrial manufacturing model that still controls thinking about education today. Unfortunately, it was faulty then and still is today. Using this model, our schools are thought of as factories. The teachers are thought of as factory workers, and the students are thought of as raw material. Each student enters the school system as a tabula rasa and exists as a book engraved with knowledge. The engraver, of course, is the teacher who is responsible for what is written. The system is devoted to mass-producing educated people, and even anecdotal observations of people clearly demonstrate that it has never worked. Had it worked, everyone who attended school would have been equally educated, just like the buttons produced in a button factory are all alike. 2.5 centuries of graduate counterexamples absolutely refute the theory. But so does the experience of most students. It is the rare graduate of any school on any level who can't name a teacher he considers exceptionally good. Yet even those teachers never taught every student in their classes equally well. Some learned a lot, some learned less, and perhaps some learned nothing. No teacher can be responsible for such disparate results. Something other than the teacher's ability must be accounted for, because each student in each class was subjected to the same presentations. Mill's methods of difference must be used to identify the other, but no reformer is attempting to use it. Blaming the teacher is so much easier, and putting the blame there proves that the improvement of education is not the aim of reformers. Even though we routinely ask children what they would like to be when they grow up, except in trivial ways, our schools rarely make attaining their goals possible, because the system is designed to make products, not educated human beings. Prospective college students are always being told, even by the president, to study subjects that the commercial community needs to carry out its enterprises. Lindsay Oldinsky, assistant professor, School of Foreign Services, Georgetown University, writes that the need to match graduates to the areas where labor demand is growing. Students are not told to study the subjects needed to become what they want to be, because unless the commercial community wants people who want to be what they want to be, this society has no place for them, which proves that this society does not exist for people, but that people exist to fulfill the purposes of the commercial community. President Obama says more scientists are needed. No one asks him why. No one points out that we don't pay any attention to those we already have. Why are more scientists who are not going to be paid attention to needed? What the commercial community wants is not scientists, but scientists who fulfill the commercial community's needs. So the schools need not produce environmentalists or climatologists or anthropologists. There's no need for them. What schools need to produce are scientists like Werner Magnus Maximilian von Braun, who was quite content to use slave labor to produce weapons of mass murder. Our commercial community needs scientists like that, and apparently quite enough of them are being produced. The educational system exists to produce factory fodder, and educational reformers are concerned not with improving education, but with producing factory fodder better. But it won't matter. It won't work. CNN recently released a list of the 16 colleges in the country that produce the highest paid graduates. Prince University was first on the list, yet only 49% of its graduates considered their jobs to be meaningful. Training for work is not education for living, not even when highly paid. The average rate of meaningful work for the 16 colleges is a mere 51%. Can you approximate the average for all workers, especially the lowest paid? What does this say about the quality of life Americans enjoy? Our reformers' love affair with technology has also shown itself to be ineffective. Americans' love for science and technology is grounded in religious-like faith, not reality. This love produces a deeply held belief that science and technology will solve all of our problems. That it may not is never even considered, so reformers go from one technology to another in an endless search for the holy grail of learning. Television was introduced into a college classrooms in the early 1960s. It enabled one professor to teach hundreds of students, but they never learned very much. A decade later, computers were introduced in the public schools. A lot of computers were bought. Little increase in learning was observed. Now the classroom is being shifted to the internet. But test scores keep dropping. Despite decades of reforms and billions of dollars spent, the American education system badly needs improvement. Yet no relevant improvement is even in sight. Most of the nation's 2012 high school graduates aren't ready for college, and their reading skills continue to steadily decline, hitting their lowest level in 40 years. In fact, piles of evidence reveal that Americans are getting dumber. You've heard me mention that many times on this program. In fact, I'm so concerned about it that I just finished writing an 880-page manuscript called Where's My Life, Dude? To help to address why two straight generations simply lack the basics in education to be able to communicate intelligently. People who have graduated from high school since the pocket calculator was invented can't calculate in their heads, not even simple addition, subtraction, multiplication. Many people addicted to the internet have difficulty reading anything more complicated than a tweet, and the technical constraints imposed by the internet are making it impossible to teach spelling and the nuances of grammar. What can seriously be written about in 140 characters? Articles become mere headlines, and headlines become mere sound bites. America is and always has been an anti-intellectual society. It is a conservative nation with deeply held conservative views. This conservatism stems from its widespread fundamentalist religious values. Numerous progressive attempts to change this have failed and are failing again. We oppose the teaching of higher-order thinking skills, what are called values clarification, critical thinking skills, and similar programs that are simply a relabeling of outcome-based education, or OBE, what is called mastery learning, which focus on behavior modification and have the purpose of challenging the student's fixed beliefs and undermining parental authority. and the Alabama legislature considered a bill to stop the teaching of evolution as a fact. That even a part of America's growing elite tries to enact such reactionary views into law means that they are attempting to make improving the American schools impossible. The American elite does not want anyone to improve American schools. America's schools will never be reformed because the culture impedes it. The reform movements are not able to educate because it's not about education. They, like everything else in America, are about money. Both the American political and economic systems rely on a thoughtless, unintelligent, uneducated populace. Einstein said that it's a miracle that curiosity survives formal education. In America, it hasn't. To become learned, a person, especially a child, must be imbued with curiosity. But marketing to children and entertaining adults are based upon mindless activities. How does watching a sporting event, a television situation comedy, a music video, a cartoon awaken your curiosity? What does any of this make a person want to learn? The culture doesn't make Americans want to learn anything about anything. Such people do not make willing students. Schooling to them is something being forced upon them. They naturally resist it. Students who don't want to learn won't. And the society has developed no means of awakening curiosity. For educational purposes, the lack of curiosity is fatal. It cannot be cured. A healthy curiosity is the only weapon against ignorance. Teaching is nothing but the art of awakening the natural curiosity of students. But learning what is taught is not enough. Learning whether what is taught makes sense is ultimately essential. Unfortunately, that aspect of educating people is not part of American education. So, in a sense, what goes on in American schools is essentially identical to what goes on in madrasas of the Muslim world. In both, Orthodox beliefs are taught as truth, and all critical examination is discouraged. Two worlds clash in loggerheads. It was the Dalai Lama who said, "Where ignorance is our master, there is no possibility of real peace." And finally, to wrap up our program today, I offer this to those who voted for Barack Obama or those at The Nation magazine who have become the corporate Democrat apologist. Here are the facts. Obama betrayed the middle class and families. He did not enact, as he promised, and expand the child and dependent care credit. They expand the Family Medical Leave Act to include leave for domestic violence or sexual assault, to create a foreclosure prevention fund for homeowners, to create a retirement savings tax credit for low income, to provide $1.5 billion to fund help states launch programs for paid family medical leave, to require employees to provide 7 paid sick days per year. He betrayed the environment, an environmentalist. In a late 2007 campaign speech, quote, "As president, I will set a hard cap on all carbon emissions at a level that scientists say is necessary to curb global warming, at an 80% reduction by 2050, end quote. Well, didn't happen. He betrayed labor. He was supposed to sign the Employee Free Choice Act, making it easier for workers to unionize, but he let the act die. He betrayed seniors, income tax for seniors making less than $50,000. He said, quote, "I will eliminate all income taxation of seniors making less than $50,000 a year. This will eliminate taxes for 7 million seniors, saving them an average of $1,400 a year. It will also mean that 27 million seniors will not need to file an income tax at all," end quote. You betrayed them, sir. Labels the GMOs. He said he would. He did not. Quote, "Let folks know when their food is genetically modified because Americans have a right to know what they're buying," end quote. And he did not. Allowed imported prescription drugs. He did not. Prevent drug companies from blocking generic drugs. He betrayed veterans, reducing the Veterans Benefit Administration backlog. He said, quote, there are currently 400,000 claims pending within the Veterans Administration. Over 800,000 claim receipts are expected, and he's going to hire. He did not. He betrayed democracy. He said he was going to forbid companies in bankruptcy from giving executive bonuses. He said, quote, protect the jobs and benefits of workers and retirees when corporations file for bankruptcy by telling companies they cannot issue bonuses for executives during bankruptcy while their workers watch their pensions disappear. But that's what happened. He did not sign in the tougher rules against revolving door for lobbyists and former officials. He did not allow the 5 days of public comment before signing bills. He did not seek independent watchdog agencies to investigate congressional ethics violations. Quote, as the president said, we will use the power of the presidency to fight for an independent watchdog agency to oversee the investigations of congressional ethics. But he did not. In fact, to the contrary, this president has had arrested or gone after more whistleblowers within the government than all other presidents combined. He did not create a public contracts and influence database. He did not expose special interest tax breaks for public scrutiny. Those are some things that he did not do. There are many more. Time is limited. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.